Welcome to Hometown California, a production of the Rural County Representatives of California, advocating for California's rural counties for nearly 50 years. Hometown California tells the rural story through the eyes of those who live, work, and play in the rural communities of the Golden State. This is Hometown California. I'm your host, Paul Smith. Frequent listeners to Hometown California may recall that as election season kicked off, we did a series of three podcasts with Leah Asgarinam, the hotline editor-in-chief for the National Journal. The first of those podcasts, we talked about the presidential race and examined the map of the Electoral College to assess Donald Trump's ability to hold on to the White House and get a second term as president. And then subsequently, Leah and I talked about the races for the U.S. Senate and how that could play out for this November election. And then the final podcast was a look at races for the House of Representatives and seeing how things evolve in that institution with respect to the upcoming November general election. So we thought we would do a check-in session to see where we are here in early October as folks start receiving ballots across the country for what promises to be and what has been thus far a very, very challenging, exciting, momentous, name the word, election season that exists. So we've brought Leah back because it was such a great series of podcasts before that we thought we would do another check-in with Leah. So with me today is Leah. It's always good to talk to you, and we always appreciate your time, Leah.
Always happy to talk.
And again, Leah writes for the National Journal, and always got to give a plug there. So Leah, real quick, just remind listeners what the National Journal is and your role.
Yeah, I'm the editor-in-chief of the Hotline at National Journal. It's the newsletter and coverage for basically everything involving elections from presidential down to state legislative races. We have a couple newsletters that go out every morning and also have a bunch of original reporting on some of the maybe untold stories of what's really happening in elections, maybe not the flashy front page stories that are easier to find.
And my understanding is Chuck Todd used to have the role you're in. Is that true?
He did. He did way back when.
The famous Chuck Todd of NBC News, who hosts Meet the Press every week.
Yep. And Amy Walter also, who is my personal favorite political person.
With the Cook Report, if I remember correctly. So very good. So we are in good hands as we break down the national election. So let's go ahead and pick up where we left off from the last podcast dealing with the presidential race. Remind the listeners that we're going to, again, revisit the Electoral College and do a check-in and see what's going on there. We'll start with going through that list of states that are reliably red and reliably blue, and then we'll really focus on those toss-up states and see where things are as we are about 30, 31 days from election. Again, as we tape here in Washington, D.C., it is just an interesting, interesting time, and we are doing it on the day that the president was reported to test positive for COVID. So the electoral world is just going buzz here. But let's go ahead and revisit those electorally predetermined states. And again, reliably blue, Washington, Hawaii, Oregon, California, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, Illinois, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. Those are what we believe are the electorally predetermined states for Joe Biden. Hard to see him losing any one of those states in the process right now. That probably brings the electoral math to about 223 electors out of the 270 that are needed to capture the White House. On the reliably red side, we'll start with Alaska, Idaho, Utah, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and West Virginia. If you add all that up, my math says Republican electors for Donald Trump's base begin at 180. So a little bit steeper number to get to 270 than where Joe Biden starts. So the toss-up states. We spent a lot of time on the last podcast. We're going to do that again and focus in on some of these states. And they are Arizona, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and the Sunshine State of Florida. So the first question for you, Leah, is, has any one of those states moved into the reliable column since early September?
So I wouldn't say that any moved into the reliable column. I think that what we've seen since we last spoke was the way things were leaning, the direction that things were going in, kind of solidified. So, for example, in Alabama, we haven't seen a change that would suggest that somebody like Doug Jones would do really well there. The opposite thing has also happened in a few states where now some states that maybe were previously seen as light red are really more purple. So I'm looking really at Iowa. That's one that is definitely in play. And really, I think Georgia at this point. I mean, we're seeing tons of polling that shows Georgia either tied or within the margin of error on the presidential ballot. So those are two races that maybe we weren't expecting to be in this conversation, but definitely are now.
So when we last spoke, we talked about comparative polling between 2016 and 2020, and we acknowledged that some of the polling difficulties that existed in 2016 are probably been cleared up. But I want to go back and look at, again, that comparative polling of month to month relative to where Hillary Clinton was in 16, where Joe Biden is today, and obviously interweave the president, Mr. Trump, in terms of what we can anticipate his performance to be. And in doing that, I want to suggest that Minnesota should be moved to the reliably blue column. It just does not seem any way that the president is going to carry Minnesota. Is that far-fetched from your analysis?
No, that sounds accurate. I mean, at this point, you'd have to see more movement. You haven't seen movement. I mean, obviously, in a state like Minnesota, just given demographics, I would never say, you know, there's a 100% chance. I wouldn't put it in the same category as, you know, Washington State, but it's not going to be a major swing state this election, I don't think.
Yeah. So if you average the public polls, Mr. Biden has a little over a 9-point average lead for the month of September. That just seems insurmountable. And quite frankly, the president doesn't necessarily need Minnesota. He did not win it in 2016. Ms. Clinton won it by 1.5%. But it was certainly a lot closer than many pundits had forecasted.
One other note about Minnesota, in addition to that major margin between the two, we're also regularly seeing Biden hit that 50% mark that we kept talking about the last time we spoke, which does indicate that even if there are swings in independent voters or undecided voters, those swings won't necessarily get over 50% because Biden's already up to 50%. So it's a more solid lead than Hillary Clinton had in 2016.
The other state I think could be easily put in the reliable category, although I know you're reluctant to do that, and that is Wisconsin. Mr. Biden has a 6.2% lead in Wisconsin, and we do not have comparative polling, at least here at Hometown California and RCRC, but 6.2% in the beginning of October in a state that the president barely carried. It just seems that's also a very insurmountable margin to overcome.
Yeah, I think so. And again, we're just hearing this news about Trump contracting coronavirus, but it's the kind of state where it's possible that, you know, an in-person rally could get some voters maybe more riled up. Like that would kind of be Republicans' best chance, is a, you know, a last minute, you know, big Trump celebration that gets people excited. And the chances of that happening are now slimmer and slimmer because we don't know what's happening with his diagnosis, but we do know that his campaign events, including one in Wisconsin, have been canceled.
You mentioned Iowa, and it's very interesting because that was on my list of items where we've seen some solidification. And I think it's safe to say it's solidified into the heavy purple. I think everyone thought that, yeah, the president's probably going to carry this. He carried it handily. Last time he won it by 9.4%. His average of polling in September of 2016 was +5. Now he's tied. All averaging of polls we saw for the month of September in Iowa, it looks like it's a dead heat.
Absolutely. It's a dead heat, and it probably needs to be a little bit more than a dead heat in order for Joni Ernst, the Republican senator, to win re-election as well. So that's definitely on the radar. There was a poll from a local station that came out today, or maybe it was late last night, that showed, at least on the Senate ballot, the Democrat Teresa Greenfield up with 51%, Ernst at just 39%. That kind of disparity is not something that's been common so far in Iowa, but it is reflecting that it's becoming a tougher and tougher state for Republicans this year.
So let's just talk about Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa for just a second. They're obviously adjacent, all three of them together. Is there something going on in that part of the upper Midwest that you think is solidifying Democrats as a whole? Is it the trade sanctions that's hurting agriculture? Is there a COVID thing? Obviously, Minnesota was where the unfortunate events of George Floyd's wrongful death occurred. What's going on there? It's very interesting to see, because I think when we come to Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, you don't see as stark a lean or shift that you do in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa.
No, I mean, it's pretty stark, even though in Ohio, we are seeing it is more competitive than you would expect it to be after Republicans had such a strong performance in 2018. I think it's everything that you just mentioned. It's a combination of all of that and how that kind of feeds into the perception of Trump. I mean, this election is a referendum on Trump, as much as Republicans who are especially down ballot might not want it to be. But Trump, especially after the most recent debate, he wants to make this election about himself. And the fact of the matter is that he's never been very popular in any of these states. He wasn't popular in these states when he won in 2016. It's just that the alternative wasn't seen as worth the chance or was seen as worse than somebody else they didn't like. What we're seeing this time is that instead of having a whole bunch of voters who dislike both candidates, a lot of voters just dislike Trump. And so Biden is kind of a safe alternative. But in terms of just those states on their own, it's important to remember that they are blue wall states. They are historically, ancestrally Democratic states. And while they might be moving toward Republicans demographically, there are still voters there who have regularly voted for Democrats their entire lives. And it's not necessarily a hard decision to pull the lever for Joe Biden.
So if we take Minnesota and Wisconsin, we put it in the reliably blue column, that gets Joe Biden to 243 electors. He only needs 27 more. That can be accomplished by just winning Florida outright, or it can be accomplished, for the most part, any combination of two states left in the toss-up world. So a combination of Michigan and Arizona gets him to that 27, or let's just say it is Pennsylvania and Ohio, or Pennsylvania and Michigan, although that would be probably one elector short, and we'll come to the Nebraska elector seat and the Maine elector seat in a minute. But nevertheless, it seems it's just going to be really, really hard in these closing weeks and closing days to basically do a clean sweep of what Mr. Trump has got left on the table with respect to the states that are in play.
Yeah, right now you'd rather be Joe Biden than Donald Trump, which it doesn't mean that Donald Trump cannot win. But if we're looking just at the multiple paths to victory that Joe Biden has and a very specific narrow one for Trump, it's just more likely that Biden ends up finding a path that works for him than Trump does, especially after some states that he was throwing out there early in the cycle, places like Nevada or New Hampshire or Minnesota. At this point, you would expect to start seeing, if there were real efforts there, some sort of movement in numbers. And we're just not seeing that.
So let's talk about a couple of these key states. Florida, I don't think we need to spend too much time. The analysis that we've done here at Hometown California says that the state is very much up for grabs. In essence, it is as 50-50 as they come. The 2020 polling averaging has Biden up 2.4, but the comparative of 2016 had Ms. Clinton up at 2.5. So just a hair off of the same amounts. The president did quite well with his overperformance relative to polls. He won by a little over 1%. So clearly, if you do a little quick math, back of the envelope math, it suggests that it is still a toss-up. Where do you see Florida right now, Leah?
Toss-up until the very last day. I mean, no matter what the polling says, which I'm assuming will remain pretty tight as it has been this cycle, that's one where it's hard to imagine a scenario in which that's not incredibly close. And as actually one of our reporters pointed out this week, Florida is likely to be one of the swing states that actually releases their results earliest on election night. So we should have a sense of if Biden is winning Florida on election night, even if we don't have results in places like Ohio or Michigan or Wisconsin, we should be able to get a sense of which direction the race is going.
So let's talk about some of these crazy states in 2016 that nobody saw coming. We'll start with Michigan. We talked about this last time. The comparative polling between Clinton and Biden in the month of September had Clinton up 5.2 in 2016, and now Biden is up 6 points in Michigan. Trump won it by 0.2%. You could argue the quick math suggests a 5.4 overperform if you want to go down that route as a metric. I don't think any professional pollster would put a whole lot of credence in this, but at least it gives you an idea. If he's performing with a 5.4 overperform and he's down 6 now, that suggests he's probably not going to win Michigan. Is that your take?
Yeah, right now he would definitely rather be Joe Biden in Michigan. And again, it's not even just the margin. It's that Trump is really struggling to even get the 45% mark, whereas Biden again and again is getting over the 50% mark in polling. At this point, it's hard to imagine how Trump pulls that off. But again, there's a lot of things that are hard to imagine right now, considering how much the world changed over the last 24 hours. So basically, right now, yes, you would rather be Joe Biden in Michigan.
The one potential bright spot that we've seen in this analysis is Pennsylvania. Ms. Clinton was up 5.2 with average polling in 2016 for the month of September. Mr. Biden is only up 5. The president won this with 0.7% margin, suggesting an overperformance of about 5.9%. So Pennsylvania, if you just kind of look at this metric alone, and again, it's not uber scientific, this would suggest Pennsylvania is still within the president's grasp.
Yeah, I think Pennsylvania is still within the president's grasp, but I also think that you'd rather be Joe Biden here as well. In terms of just the direction of polling, things look good for Biden. Things are trending in his direction, which is especially important at this point in the cycle when things are beginning to solidify. It just kind of has the perfect demographic of voters that Joe Biden has been wanting to target, the white working class voters who used to like Barack Obama and then supported Donald Trump. That's kind of Biden's bread and butter. And that's a great state for him there for that reason. But we've also seen Biden struggle with a lot of non-white voters. And so I think there you could see that might be where some of his weaknesses are in states like Florida and in states like Pennsylvania.
So right next door is the Buckeye state of Ohio. The president carried the state with a very, very healthy margin of 8.1%. When he was running during the month of September, the polls had him winning at 4.3. So there was about a 3.8% overperformance comparatively. The average of pollings right now for the month of September have Biden up 3.3. So again, if you believe that overperformance margin can be translated from 2016 to 2020 for the month of September, it would suggest that Ohio is still gettable for Mr. Trump. A reminder again, it is virtually impossible for a Republican to be elected president without carrying Ohio. How much do you see Ohio really going into the blue column? And if you're looking at the overall map, is this where you're going to put your resources versus some of the other states that we think are in play?
If you're Trump, yes, you put resources into this state, because while you'd rather be Trump in this situation than Joe Biden in Ohio, Biden doesn't need to win Ohio, and Trump is not running away with this race at all. Whereas Biden has pretty comfortable leads in places like Minnesota, even a lot of polls of Pennsylvania and Michigan, in Ohio it's just consistently neck and neck. And whereas that's kind of a good thing for Biden in places like Georgia, because you would never expect that. This is not where Trump wants to be. And as you said, it is a must-win state for him. So if you are a Republican, if you are Trump, this is, if not one of the main priorities, the main priority.
So the two states we spent a lot of time talking about last time were Arizona and North Carolina, particularly in the context of a electoral realignment relative to Republicans making great inroads in the upper Midwest, but potentially as a result of their narrative and their messaging, they could potentially lose Arizona and North Carolina. So let's talk about North Carolina first. North Carolina, the president won with a margin of victory of 3.6%. His average polling in 2016 was 1.7. So obviously it did show him winning. Tight race, but nevertheless he won. So about a 1.9% overperformance. Joe Biden has been leading in the polls and averaging a lead of 1.8%. So theoretically, there's still an ability for Donald Trump to carry this, but this seems to be a lot more tight 4 years later.
Right. It's kind of in the tilt Democratic category, but I do wonder how that's going to change in the next few days, actually. We saw a poll today from a Democratic pollster, ALG Research, which found Biden leading Trump in the state 50-47%, which is, you know, it's a Democratic poll. So taking that into account, you'd think it's a neck and neck race. But they also surveyed the Senate ballot and found the Democratic candidate Cal Cunningham ahead of the Republican incumbent Tom Tillis, 53-41%. Cal Cunningham also just closed his quarter three fundraising with $28 million. It just seems like momentum is on Democrat side right now. And in the next few days, it will be interesting to see if Republicans show anything to say that they're stopping that momentum or reversing it, or if this is the beginning of the end for Republicans this year in North Carolina.
The last state is the Grand Canyon state of Arizona. Big, big political swing from 2016 polling and dynamics, and quite frankly, big swings in the last 3 or 4 weeks. The president carried this 3.6%. He led polling of September in 2016 with about a 1.5% margin. This time in 2020, Biden has a 4.7% average lead. So even if you factor in the overperformance from 2016, this has become very, very tight in a state that seems that if Donald Trump cannot win this state, he has definitely lost the presidency.
Arizona is just wild this cycle. It seems like you keep talking about a realignment and how this has kind of slowly been taking place over the last decade. And then the last 3 years in Arizona have just seen a huge sea change. So starting with Trump narrowly carrying the state in 2016, and then Democrats winning the Senate in 2018. And now it looks like Democrats are on the path to win the presidency and the Senate there again in 2020. It's pretty incredible how quickly that change happened. But Trump is not out of this race. It is still very much possible for Trump to win Arizona. But at this late stage in the race, he's not the favorite to win here at all.
So my quick math says if Michigan goes Democrat, he needs only one more state that's got at least 11 electors. So combination of Michigan and Arizona puts him into the White House. But again, combination of any two states after solidifying Minnesota and Wisconsin, it's Joe Biden's. Do you see any role for those states that have independent electors, i.e. Nebraska and Maine, factoring here? Or does it just not matter because Joe Biden is just doing so strong in so many other states that it probably will not come down to that?
Yeah, at this point, it looks like he's doing well in a whole bunch of states. So I don't see it coming down to something like that where it's that narrow. I think the biggest question mark right now is how quickly ballots are counted in all of these different places. And also, there will be conversations about people who say their vote did not count, just like what we saw in Georgia in 2018 because of some kind of procedural issue or misunderstanding with ballots. I think that's probably the more likely conflict when this is all over. That, and of course, if Trump decides that the election is rigged and he loses, that's a whole other can of worms that could lead to some conflict, to say the least.
So of our swing states, toss-up states, what have you, which of them have already started voting or will begin voting because the ballots have either landed or we know should be landing as early as October 4th or 5th?
Most of them, if they have not already started voting, they will have in the next week or two. North Carolina is the first state to send out ballots, so that's pretty early. What's going to be interesting is places like Texas, where there's really no mail-in voting for early voting. It's only if you're over age 65, you can, I think, somehow request it. But at this point, a lot of ballots have already been sent in key swing states. And from what we've seen so far, those ballots tend to be from Democrats. Now, that doesn't mean that Democrats can't vote for Republicans. They can. And it doesn't mean that Democrats aren't cannibalizing their own votes. Maybe these people would have come out on election day. But it does mean that Republicans are going to have a lot more work to do than Democrats as election day approaches, because they need to turn out more voters on election day than Democrats will need to.
Where are the media buys right now? Where's the president put his money? Where has Joe Biden put his money in these toss-up states? Where do you see the needle being moved either way? Just strictly on those money buys.
With Trump, it's fluctuated a couple times. We've seen Trump go in and out of a handful of states. Biden, his energy has generally been in those blue wall states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, those bread and butter states. And now we're beginning to see some possible investments in places like Texas and Georgia, where Joe Biden doesn't need to win. But if he does want an electoral mandate because of a landslide, or at least a really strong victory, those are the kinds of places that he can now go into if he's feeling comfortable in places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, et cetera.
So we're going to obviously spend some time on the Senate in just a moment, but let's talk about the big, big political elephant in the room, and that is obviously the Supreme Court vacancy. How do you think the nominee of Amy Coney Barrett shapes the president's reelection efforts? Do you think it more motivates the base? Does it more motivate Republican suburban women? Does it turn them off? Where do you think the politics play with that nomination for Donald Trump?
The timeline for the confirmation process of a Supreme Court nominee was already incredibly tight. If, as Trump wanted, Republicans were going to confirm somebody before Election Day, that was already going to be a really tough task, but a doable one. Now that we're seeing some senators today, Mike Lee of Utah, who have tested positive for coronavirus, and Trump testing positive and knowing that he's spoken with other Republicans who, if you do the whole contact tracing game, it's definitely possible that another senator could test positive in the next couple of days, which, if that does happen, would slow down the process of confirming someone. So that's the caveat. But assuming that this process does go as planned, it seems that white women who do not have a college degree do not want this confirmation to happen before Election Day. They do not like that this is being rushed. Now, that's according to several polls that actually go down to crosstabs that deep, you know, the white non-college educated women crosstab. But it does show that there's room for Trump's base to contract. There's not necessarily room for his base to just fall apart or flock at this point. But there are some signs of weakness, and it is with women. There's a huge gender gap in all of the polling we see.
Even though he has nominated a woman who, regardless of what people think of her rulings, represents, I think, a strong conservative approach in what we think will be her views on the court.
Yeah. As much as Republicans, especially this cycle, are trying to recruit women because they think it's an electoral advantage, in general, women don't vote for women because they're women. There's been a whole bunch of studies into this, and that's just not a key finding. So just because she's a woman doesn't mean that women are going to get behind her, even though that's clearly something that was in the political calculus from folks like Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell. So in the end, even Joe Biden, he's losing with men. So men aren't voting for Joe Biden because he's a man. I guess he's also facing another man, so that might not count. This whole process has highlighted some weaknesses, but are those attitudes going to correlate with behavior is the key question. I don't think it's going to be the Supreme Court on its own that is going to make some of these few women who are still with Donald Trump abandon him. But you can see how maybe a kind of confluence of events would be enough to tip the scales. In general, though, we're seeing much more of an impact of the Supreme Court drama on Senate races than on the presidential race. On the presidential race, in general, we can see signs of potential weaknesses, but things have pretty much solidified.
So let's move to the U.S. Senate. Let's remind our folks that the makeup of the Senate right now is 53 Republicans, 45 Democrats, and two independents. The two independents caucus with the Democrats, so it's a functional 53-47. Assuming that Alabama goes from blue to red, the Democrats need to pick up five seats if they do not hold the White House, i.e. the vice president who would cast a tie. Or they only need four pickups with Senator Harris becoming the vice president and then breaking that tie. Everything suggests a very, very tight window here between whether the Republicans can hold on or the Democrats can take the Senate back and basically hold all three of the functioning governmental bodies. So is that still kind of your conventional wisdom of how things stand, or is there something that has changed in the last few weeks that makes this either a slam dunk Republican hold or a slam dunk Democratic gain?
I think the biggest change over the last couple of weeks has been the Supreme Court's effect on Susan Collins in Maine and Cory Gardner in Colorado. If those races were seen as the toughest races for Republicans this cycle a month ago, I would say Republicans are pretty severe underdogs in both of those races now. So even though that's only two races that really could have gone either way a month ago, I think I would put them in the Democratic column at this point. That's a huge change. And that also means that Democrats can focus on nearly a dozen other states to piece together at least a few of them to get to the majority.
Let's go back through that list and we'll catch up with Ms. Collins in Maine and Mr. Gardner in Colorado. Alabama, anything suggests that Doug Jones, the incumbent senator, can beat Tommy Tuberville and hold on to the seat in what is a very, very, very Republican, very conservative state?
Nope. No, there's not. Nothing has changed there. It would have to change by now, I think, in order to get a sense of how Democrats could win there. But just no sign that Doug Jones can make this work.
So again, all Dems need to do here is pick up four seats, assuming that Joe Biden wins. So let's start with him. Arizona. This is Mr. Kelly, Mark Kelly, the astronaut, as we all call him, versus the incumbent appointed Senator Martha McSally. All of the polls I've seen, a huge lead for Mark Kelly. Some would say insurmountable. Is that your read?
Yes, it is. It would fall into the Democratic column, given the two options.
And Colorado, which you've already alluded to, incumbent Republican Cory Gardner facing the former governor, John Hickenlooper, in what seems to be a very, very, very blue, if not lightly shaded purple state. Cory Gardner won in a wave election for Republicans in the last 2 years of Mr. Obama's term. It doesn't seem like he's going to be able to hold on.
No, we haven't seen any indication of this changing. Gardner has been behind the entire cycle, and it's been pretty stagnant at this point.
And the president seems to be deeply unpopular in Colorado, so that's probably not helping Mr. Gardner at all.
Nope, that's right.
And then we are on to Maine, and this is where Susan Collins, the longtime Senate moderate Republican, I think most would characterize her, facing the Speaker of the Maine lower house, Ms. Gideon. Again, polls show Collins is really, really on the ropes.
Yeah, the writing on the wall for me was looking at a poll that Republicans decided to release, conducted by Republicans, that showed Sarah Gideon, the Democrat, and Susan Collins tied at 42%. That means if Republicans are releasing those numbers, you know, Republicans poll internally all the time. And when numbers aren't good, they don't tend to release them. They use them for their own personal strategy. The fact that Republicans released a poll that had them both tied at 42% just suggests to me that Susan Collins is in really bad shape.
So that's three of the four. We come to the fourth one, which we already talked about. This is incumbent Tom Tillis of North Carolina facing Mr. Cunningham. I have not seen a poll that shows Tom Tillis within 5 points for the last month. Am I not getting the correct information, or is Tom Tillis just that flawed of a Republican incumbent senator?
He's come within 6 points, I think, a few times. But yeah, up until recently, Cal Cunningham was getting low enough margins where you could imagine that Tillis could catch up. So even if Cunningham was above by 5 points, Tillis still had plenty of room to grow. But at this point, we're not seeing that growth. And we are seeing polls where Cunningham is growing. So that's not good news for Tom Tillis.
So those four seats are the low-hanging fruit for Democrats. Is there any suggestion that big money will come into play to help the Republicans? You alluded that Cal Cunningham is vastly outraising Tom Tillis. Is there some money that we don't know that's coming or anticipate from the outside groups or perhaps the Republican Senate committee? Is there anything that you're aware of that could come in and really change the tide of any one of these in-play seats that Republicans seem about to lose?
Republicans are spending in these races. They haven't walked away at all. And there's plenty of outside groups to help them make up some of the gap. But in the end, in addition to the fundraising that Cal Cunningham saw, we're expecting a huge surge also for outside groups after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg because of Democratic outrage over Trump deciding to fill that seat. So in the end, Republicans have more money to put into these races. They're not walking away, but Democrats are going to have more.
Let's talk about what I like to call some of the gravy seats, the seats that the Democrats don't necessarily need, but boy, it sure would be nice because you don't want to just have a one-seat majority. You'd like to have several, particularly if the filibuster rule is maintained. Let's start with Iowa. You referred to this where Teresa Greenfield is running against incumbent Republican Joni Ernst. And again, polls here are showing Ms. Greenfield is not only viable, but probably the ultimate winner. What's your take there?
Teresa Greenfield was kind of an unknown quantity before 2020. She was a candidate in a 2018 House race, had to withdraw because her campaign manager forged signatures. And it was a really embarrassing campaign incident from this woman who was seen as a rising star. And so because it was kind of seen as a generic Democrat, I think throughout the cycle, it just appeared that she would do however well Joe Biden did, or maybe a couple points below that. But now we're beginning to see that it looks like Teresa Greenfield might actually overperform Joe Biden, and that it's possible Teresa Greenfield wins without Joe Biden winning Iowa. So that's probably her biggest advantage right now.
And then Montana, Bullock versus Daines. This is one where Mr. Daines seems to be hanging in there. I won't say quite handedly, but given his five other colleagues that we just talked about, he seems like he can hang on here. Your assessment and analysis of this seat?
Yeah, this is a true toss-up. We haven't seen tons of polls. In the polls we have seen, Daines has had a slight advantage, but also just Montana is a more red state than blue state. It has some purple tendencies, but the top of the ballot is going to be a wait for Steve Bullock. And Democrats will say, well, he did it before. He did it in 2016 as governor. But voters do not look at governor's races the same way they look at Senate races. Voters know that when they vote for a senator, they're voting for a majority or a minority in a governing body. So if they both enter Election Day at relatively the same level, whereas in other states, you might actually give Democrats a bit of an advantage just nationally because of the political environment. In places like Montana, you might actually give the Republican a bit of an advantage, all other things remaining the same.
And just remind the podcast listeners, incumbent Steve Daines is the Republican, and he is facing the soon-to-be former governor, Steve Bullock, who obviously is a Democrat. The next state is the one that I think we've spent a lot of time talking about. I think we're going to continue to talk about it, although it looks as though if those first four seats we talked about for Democrats being able to do some pickups, it might not matter. But it's Georgia, because you've got two Senate seats up, one in the traditional manner, and then one that is a special election to ultimately fill the seat of former Senator Isaacson. Let's start with the easy one first, and that is incumbent Senator David Perdue running against John Ossoff. Perdue is the son of Sonny Perdue, who is in the Trump administration. And Mr. Perdue, I believe, was either the governor or the senator or both. And so his son, David, is continuing the family tradition in Georgia politics. Polling that I've seen gives David Perdue a slight edge, but theoretically, it shouldn't be this close. Does Ossoff still have a chance?
Ossoff has a chance. This is one of the toughest races to analyze because we're seeing really close margins in the mid to high 40s. But if no candidate receives 50%, it goes to a runoff. So even if Ossoff does get more votes than Perdue, that doesn't mean that he's going to win. And then what we have to do is then look at the political environment in January and decide how that's going to affect the race. So let's say it's 49-49 in November. How does Biden, if he's in the White House, how does that affect the way voters respond? Does that energize Republicans? Or if it turns out that Democrats are one seat shy of the majority in the Senate and this one January race determines who has the Senate majority, what does that political environment look like? So I think it's pretty likely that both of these races will head to runoffs, less likely that the Perdue one will, because it's still absolutely possible for somebody to get 50%. It is a two-man race for all intents and purposes. But since we're just not seeing that 50% mark hit in polling, it could go into January. And if it goes into January, I don't know what will happen.
So that brings us to the seat currently held by appointed incumbent Kelly Loeffler. The November race is basically a jungle primary with the top two candidates going in. All polls indicate the race is very tight between the three candidates, incumbent appointed Senator Kelly Loeffler, her Republican challenger, Congressman Doug Collins, and then Raphael Warnock seems to be the favored Democratic choice, although he's got some competition on that side. And they all seem to be polling within 2 points of each other. Is this one we just are not going to know till a week after the election in Georgia?
Despite what you're seeing in the polls, there's a lot of confidence that Raphael Warnock will be in the runoff, or at least will be the Democratic nominee, whatever that means. There's some effort right now for Democrats nationally trying to get the other Democrats out of the race who aren't Raphael Warnock, because if Warnock does get 50% in November, then he could be seated early and possibly help Democrats avoid a confirmation hearing for the Supreme Court nominee. So that's a whole kind of subplot playing out on social media and in activist circles. But assuming that doesn't happen, and even if it were to happen, there's a good chance that this is a runoff between Warnock and then Kelly Loeffler or Doug Collins. And we don't really know which of those two it's going to be. But we do know that right now, Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins are running primary campaigns. They're running Republican primary campaigns in a state that Joe Biden might win, which is not a great place to be in October of 2020, even if the runoff isn't until January.
So it's very interesting, the developments that have occurred in Georgia over the last week. The former Republican governor of Georgia, Nathan Deal, has endorsed Doug Collins, again, sitting House member, who obviously I think is giving up his seat to run for the Senate in this primary. Yet the current governor, Brian Kemp, appointed Kelly Loeffler. So you have kind of a duel between the current Republican governor and the Republican governor of just 2 years ago, Nathan Deal. What's going on there?
What's even wilder is that the Speaker of the State House is on Collins' side. Brian Kemp, who appointed Loeffler, actually ran a campaign a lot like the Doug Collins campaign in 2018. He was running a pretty far-right campaign with ads that went viral for pretty much for being offensive. And now he's picking Kelly Loeffler over somebody who's actually running a campaign pretty similar to his, a pretty Trumpian campaign. It's just creating this kind of weird Republican civil war in Georgia, which is even more interesting because it is a bit of a microcosm of the greater Republican divisions that, you know, are really hurting the party and that are making places like Texas and like Georgia competitive to begin with.
So what is with Georgia? Why is this change occurring so fast? Because unlike Arizona, which we talked about, which is undergoing some cultural changes, obviously a large Latino population that's growing, obviously suburban women, a lot of people leaving California and moving to Arizona. And so you're getting that influx too, which is changing the body politic. Georgia, why are these races so competitive at the Senate level? What's going on in Georgia?
It's the suburbs. It's also that there's a really sizable Black population. But Georgia is, unlike Texas, it's not a majority-minority state. It's predominantly white. But white voters are not monolithically with Donald Trump. There's that whole college-educated suburban vote where we saw in 2018, at the beginning of the cycle, so technically in 2017, that Georgia 6 special where Democrats just couldn't make the cut with John Ossoff. But we saw Democrats flip that seat a year later with Lucy McBath over Karen Handel. So that plus in 2018, you had Stacey Abrams' major gubernatorial campaign where she not only activated voters, but built an entire infrastructure, brought money into the state for Democratic causes. If you're kind of just doing the demographic math, there's a Democratic base there. The question is whether if you turn every person who would vote for a Democrat out, is it going to get you to 49% or 48% or 51%? And that's for Stacey Abrams. She wasn't able to get to that point, but who knows what could happen in 2020.
So it all seems there's a common theme here in that none of these races seem to necessarily reflect the politics of what's going on internally in the state. We talked a little bit about this in the last podcast. It seems like these are all proxy races on the president. Is that what the polling is showing when you read it?
The 2020 election is a referendum on President Trump. And that's not unique to presidential year. And in general, presidential turnout drives down ballot races. So in that sense, it's not unique. What is unique is the intensity of political polarization. That means that fewer people will split their tickets, which means that if you dislike Trump, you're going to vote for whoever's not in Trump's party all down the ballot. I don't want to dismiss the impact that presidential races historically have had on down ballot races, but it does seem like this is pretty unprecedented territory.
So our last discussion here, and then we're going to wrap it up, just stay focused on the Senate and the presidential race and not really look at the House since there doesn't seem to be too much drama. But nevertheless, is Lindsey Graham of South Carolina really in trouble?
Yes, he is in trouble. He is in trouble because he is being vastly outraised and because he is not polling super well in a state where he should be polling super well. And he has enemies. He has enemies in the Lincoln Project, which has kind of taken a special personal approach to that particular race because of the late John McCain's relationship with Lindsey Graham. And Jamie Harrison has just been a really effective candidate since the beginning. He's kind of been a bit of a sweetheart in Democratic circles. Now, so is Amy McGrath. And Amy McGrath was never really going to go anywhere with that and challenging Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. That was always going to be a pretty impossible race for her. But we're seeing that in South Carolina, it's possible that Lindsey Graham's posturing with Trump, the pretty severe flip from being a Trump critic to a Trump loyalist, is going to turn off some moderate voters. And it's also going to turn off some base voters. And so there's enough of the softness there where Democrats with the right conditions could take advantage.
Time seems to fly when we have these discussions. Leah, on behalf of Hometown California, really thank you again for participating in this discussion. We're going to do one more pre-election podcast with Leah on the eve of the election, and hopefully it's aired before folks head to the polls, particularly in those states where you still can go to the polls. But we thank you a lot. Very insightful. I know our listeners have been very excited to hear about these conversations. So stay safe, stay well. And again, thank you so much for your insights today. Leah Ascarinum of the National Journal.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Make sure to download our previous podcasts on the national election. You can reach them from a variety of platforms, including the RCRC website.
You've been listening to Hometown California, a production of the Rural County Representatives of California. Subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and be sure to rate and review this podcast. I'm your host, Paul Smith, and thanks for listening.